Hi, this is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We always like to hear what you're thinking. Today, we are talking with James Poulos. He's an author and a writer and a journalist who's done some work for Reason as well as many other places, including The Week, The Daily Beast, you name it. He's got a fantastic new book out that is called The Art of Being Free. How Alexis de Tocqueville can save us from ourselves. James, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, Nick, it's a total pleasure.
Yeah, and I apologize already for mangling the subtitle. It's How Alexis de Tocqueville Can Save Us From Ourselves. Now, you talk about the art of being free. That's what this is, kind of a self-help book and a political philosophy book and a cultural commentary book all rolled into one. It captivated me like very few books have in a very long time, because it strikes me this is almost like a manifesto for Americans who are kind of on the horns of a dilemma of chasing material wealth and material well-being, but also feeling unfulfilled by everything in life. Is that a fair kind of summary of what you're talking about?
Yeah, that is. I mean, we all know that right now, as we speak, Donald Trump has just finished his first big presser, and it went about as everyone expected. We know that this is a sort of gong show moment for us politically, but America has been full of gong show moments. You know, it's almost the history of gong show moments. And so there's that focal point for the insanity of American life. People are sort of coming to recognize or admit that maybe there's a craziness that's baked into American life that goes far beyond politics. And that, if, you know, even setting politics to the side might give us more of an awareness of just how and just why it seems that the anxiety and awkwardness and loneliness and turmoil of everyday life is something that we can't get away from. It's not like a problem that can be solved or an illness that can be cured.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about you in the book. You talk about at one point you use the phrase that we need to, or we should be trying to dispel the sense of haunted despair. You mentioned, you know, Tocqueville can save us from ourselves. Talk a little bit about what is that despair? What is that haunted despair? What, you know, set the scene for what's wrong with America in the current moment. And I think you would tend to agree that Donald Trump is not necessarily the cause of this, but might be the reflection of it. He's almost kind of, we've conjured him in order to personify where we are as a society.
Well, that's right. You know, I was talking to some friends on the left the other day about how to process Obama's departure from the White House. And, you know, they talked about how emotional it was, not in like a soap operatic way, but in like a, you know, we felt like everything was fine and now it's not. And, you know, should we have known over the past 4 years that things were, you know, were not so fine all along? And I think, you know, spending some time with that kind of realization will put you in the right frame of mind to start thinking through what Tocqueville has had to say about these kinds of feelings of melancholy and detachedness and rootlessness that have run through the American character, you know, almost since the beginning. So, you know, we've got this pervasive loneliness. We've got the anxiety. And for Tocqueville, these are the hallmarks of this kind of great transition that we're moving through sociologically.
Yeah, talk about the great transition, because that's also a key concept in the book. So, and this is a transition which, in a certain level, it is, as you were saying, it's baked into the American experience, the American experiment. But what is the great transition?
So, you know, the book is called Democracy in America, which is, you know, true but misleading, as one of my favorite lines from the movie Clue goes. The aristocratic age, as Tocqueville puts it, you know, is what came before. You have fixed hierarchical relationships. People are defined more by their roles than by their, you know, personalities or individual preferences. And that structure has collapsed. There's no going back to it. We can't re-enchant the world. We can't seek refuge in this sort of reactionary lifestyles that some of my friends on the right, you know, wish that we could pursue as sort of a shelter from the craziness of the world.
Could I also ask, do some of your friends on the left also kind of pine for something similar to that, where it's, you know, this is particularly on the populist left, where you hear, oh, if only we could recapture 1955, where people were in labor unions and manufacturing jobs were okay and everybody was winning in the economy. And, you know, you, and whenever you look backwards at these things, there's always that you're fixing things in a way that you think everybody was benefiting from, but in fact, a lot of people were suffering or just simply cast aside. But is there, if we are talking about not so much the aristocratic age, but an age in which relations among people and things and class and race are fixed, that's a nostalgia that affects
right.
all types of ideology.
Yeah, that's right. And then we've also now got this even more dislocating experience of feeling nostalgic for a future that we thought was coming and never seemed to arrive. There are conservative and progressive variants of that, and that's part of what's going on here as well. But just to sort of finish off on what the Great Transition is all about. Although the aristocratic age has collapsed, Tocqueville says, and we're proceeding into or toward the democratic age, we're not fully within it yet. The rubble of the aristocratic age is still around us, and some of those categories of thought and patterns of experience, you know, are not things that we can just shake off with some kind of abstract ideology or revolutionary pose. Things like pride and envy still exist. Things like, you know, sort of what's left of traditional family structures still exist. And when we find ourselves moving into a more fully democratic mode, on the surface, it seems like good news. Tocqueville describes this moment of great, you know, jubilation and optimism when people realize that the old constraints have fallen away. And so there's this moment where dynamism increases and commerce increases and idealism increases. There's great exchange of information and feelings and sentiments. And then people begin to realize that what Tocqueville calls invisible barriers have started to spring up in sort of a horizontal way, that equality isn't all fun and games. Suddenly we're all trying to compete for the same sorts of things. There's what Peter Thiel calls a convergence of desire. Suddenly it's not, you know, it's not that big of a deal if you've been to college. Suddenly, you know, every person in preschool needs like an admissions counselor, and that kind of scramble to just edge out people who are, you know, increasingly just like you is something that really wears on us. And it's a hallmark of this transitional time that honestly, you know, it could go on for a long while. It could be, you know, another couple centuries or maybe more before we go into full, you know, quote unquote democratic mode.
Yeah. Is this, I mean, on a certain level, is the Great Transition, and I know that you've spent time in grad school. I too in the humanities, and this was back in the late 80s and early 90s before the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, and I was in literary and cultural studies, so a lot of people were looking forward to the end of what at that point they called late capitalism. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they started calling it advanced capitalism. And a couple of them were like, holy hell, maybe there isn't a next stage. Maybe you leave behind the world that we left behind, say, in 1800 with the start of the Industrial Revolution or the political upheavals in Europe by, you know, in the 1840s. And all we're going to have now is this kind of ongoing existential crisis, which is capitalism and liberal political reform. My point here is simply that, you know, maybe there's no way out of this, that this is the human condition for as, you know, for as long as we will be alive, even if we do manage to live to be 200 or 300 years old. With that as a backdrop, I guess my question is, you talk in the book, and I think this kind of captures some of where, you know, where we're at in this particular moment. You say we love equality, we want unity, and we fear uniformity. Talk a little bit about how that, you know, when you're talking about, yeah, we want equal opportunity, but we don't necessarily want equal outcomes because we all want to be a little bit different. And we also, you know, we want to be on the same team, but, you know, we want to be the captain of the team.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think this is a good moment to talk a bit about capitalism in respect to these kinds of questions. You know, Tocqueville is a social theorist. He did not think that economics was the master science. And that's not to cast aspersions on, mm-hmm. on economists. But I think, you know, part of the feeling of withdrawal that many people have gone through since 9/11 and since 2008 has been this kind of crushing realization that perhaps economics does not really explain the world as well as maybe some other things. So for Tocqueville, you know, money was an excellent example of how what on the surface looks like an increase inequality. Obviously, income inequality has been this obsession in recent years. And, you know, it's just people aren't just pulling this out of thin air. I mean, the fact is that folks who have outsized talent and ambition are able to kind of punch through that barrier of competitiveness that seems to be holding a lot of people back or makes them feel like they're increasingly insignificant and interchangeable. And those people get rewards. They just do. And they get rewards in a way that the rest of us, you know, often don't, even if on net our lives are materially better off than they would otherwise be. So, you know, even though we have all these absolute gains, when we see a few people get those relative gains in a big way, and then they start acting like they're, you know, a species apart, and they live in walled gardens, and they throw parties that we can never get into, you know, it does trigger some envy. But as money creates what looks like fundamental inequalities, Tocqueville suggests, in fact, no, there are deeper equalities that are giving rise to these little inequalities that take on such big significance for us. So, you know, the theme there that Tocqueville draws out and that I try to cast light on in the book in a way that makes intuitive sense right now is that Americans like liberty, but they love equality. And if they're forced to choose between one or the other, our aptitude or our temptation is to side with equality, even if we know that we're going to sacrifice freedom. I mean, I think honestly, you nailed it in a great Daily Beast column from a while back when you said, look, as government becomes more inept and cumbersome, the desire to make government even more powerful so that those defects can be cured actually seems to grow among people. And that's something that fuels kind of this fear and desire that attaches to money in our everyday life.
Does that, I mean, but that also means we can never, I mean, if we're, you know, this kind of going back to, Tocqueville's time, this is, and I'm not sure if leeches were still being used, but it's kind of like the patient isn't being cured, you know, with leeches, let's add more leeches. I mean, it seems like it's only going to speed up and perpetuate the problem that it's trying to solve.
Yeah, there is this kind of, you know, pathological make leeches great again attitude. And I think, you know, this kind of goes to the root of why I bothered writing this book in the mm-hmm. first place was we have economic problems. We have political problems. Many policies are not good and they're being pursued anyway, doubled down on. Mm-hmm. It is frustrating and annoying and depressing. And plus, we've got, you know, more than one political tribe of people saying, no, in fact, it is you whose policies are wrong and mine are right. And that whole basket of rancor and division. You know, politics is the place for that kind of activity. And that's fine. On the other hand, what if the needful thing was to sort of take a big step back from that hurricane of what, you know, Tocqueville described as mental dust just swirling around us? What if what we needed to do in order to regain perspective on the reality of freedom and the manner in which freedom is always a choice that we can make involved just bracketing that stuff for a second and answering some more basic questions about who and how we are in the world? And what if by sort of beginning to answer those questions, we would then put ourselves in a position individually and socially where we could start to rephrase questions like, well, you know, given all this stuff that we've just considered, what sort of relationship to our government do we want to have? What sort of possibilities can we create in that site once we've sort of cleared it of these arrests and these impasses that seem to block us at every turn?
Well, you know, one of the things that immediately struck me, I think it's on page 4, according to my notes, you point out, and when you read a book called The Art of Being Free, how Tocqueville can, fix your bunions, you know, you're I'm expecting okay, this is going to be an interesting book. I'm into politics, political philosophy, but you stress this is not a political book and that it's a kind of Californian take on Tocqueville. And that actually hooked me even more because it calls to mind some of the anti-political kind of social manifestos of reawakening that came out in the 60s, whether it's stuff by Marshall McLuhan and The Medium is the Massage, or even Charles Reich, who wrote The Greening of America, or Roberts, and I'm blanking on his last name, the guy who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, where these are
Persig.
Thank you, Robert Persig, which shares with your book that when I first picked up that book because I was trying to fix a bicycle and I thought I might get some tips on it as a kid. And it's all about the Phaedra or whatever. It's a book by a man who, you know, admits that he was mentally psychotic for a while, and he's in dialogue with Socrates and Plato. Your list of references, which is just wonderful. I mean, I was just scratching down things. You talk about Socrates and Nietzsche and Macklemore and Netflix and Seinfeld and Plato and Stendhal, Scooby-Doo. You know, and Beck, the musician. This is a cavalcade of like just wide-ranging, wonderful references and allusions. But to get back to it and what you're talking about, this is not a political book, and you focus, your chapter headings include change, faith, money, play, sex, death, love. Very few of those, or none of those, are about you know, how to put together a block watch and make sure that everybody on your block voted the way that you wanted them to. How do we escape politics in a world where politics seems to subsume every conversation that everybody of every ideological position has?
Yeah, I mean, it's less a matter of trying to retreat from that aspect of the world than realizing, you know, there's not cheese down that tunnel with regard to what, you know, the this is not the cheese you're looking for, to use another metaphor. So, you know,
So if I can ask, I mean, so I understand it, or I hope I'm getting it right, but, you know, you're saying, you know, a lot of us are unhappy. A lot of us feel alienated and isolated, and just like, you know, what we're doing isn't making us feel better. It's not making us feel fulfilled. It's not making us nicer to our spouses, to our children, to our coworkers, to our neighbors. And that part of the reason might be because politics has dominated in a way, or we're looking for meaning and significance in that, down that tunnel. And there's all of these other places that we should be spending more time on.
What is it that we're bringing into politics right now that's causing so much trouble? It's the self, you know, it's about me, the politics of me. Or it's about the politics of us, you know, identity politics and my tribe and my, you know, it's a fill in the blank thing you wouldn't understand. Those kinds of frames of reference are exercising such a profound influence over politics. And in fact, you know, it's those approaches to kind of identifying your place in the world that I would argue are illusions by and large. A big theme of the book is that who you are matters a lot less than how you are. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that who you are is utterly insignificant. You know, it's to say that if life seems overwhelming and dissatisfying and you are filled with the sort of low grade panicking and anxiety over how things seem to be going, don't look to, you know, what Hamlet looked to, which was, well, maybe I can create this weird hall of mirrors called the self that I can use to deflect various attacks on me, and I can also use to sort of manipulate my way through tough situations. You know, we saw that movie. We saw how it ends. It doesn't end well, right? Like the self is not going to save us. And the news isn't going to save us. Just trying to double down on survival in the minute to minute of life is going to make matters worse. I mean, Tocqueville himself says, you know, the Americans, their reason, what's the line? Something like their reason persists even after their mind begins to fail them. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of like insane desire to keep on trying to solve the puzzle of life. even when we realize that that we're not getting the results that we want. So yeah, you know, there is this kind of this Californian West Coast Zen-like approach that I think can help us. And the third chapter in the book is really all about sort of my Christianity and how it's not this comprehensive doctrine that provides a sort of escape from the world. It's something else. And my hope is that...
Talk about your Christianity, which I'm not sure I fully recognize as someone who was raised Roman Catholic. I suspect that you are... you know, you were raised in one of those cults that is ineluctably leading you to the doorstep of hell. But what is your Christianity? And then how, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about it is that you talk about how it is part of who you are, but it is not a kind of totalist system that explains every day how you, you know, what you should do when you get up and what you should be doing 15 minutes later, et cetera. It's something else. But it's important to you. But it is also not a endless set of directives to do this, don't do that.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's not an algorithm. It's not a comprehensive solution to the problem of making your way through the world. You know, some of my favorite pastors who I've encountered like to say things like Christianity is impossible. You know, it's supposed to be impossible. That doesn't mean you don't try. That doesn't mean that you don't, you know, focus yourself and orient your soul around these practices and the commitments that are tied up in them. It doesn't mean don't have conviction. But it does mean, like, you know, we human beings are born to die and we are born to err, and making mistakes and being imperfect and falling short of the mark is just part of our human equipment. And it is the daily task is to go on anyway, to, you know, in a way that has some integrity to it, and to which you can be held to account, and a way that works. So to reassure the listener or not, depending on who the listener is, I was, in fact, not raised in the cult, but there is sort of an interesting story here, which libertarians might especially appreciate for whatever reason. My father, third-generation full-blooded Greek guy, born in Detroit, grew up in Detroit, has memories, of course, of being in the Greek Orthodox Church, you know, as a four-year-old, five-year-old. Standing there in the church for Easter service and singing the hymns in Greek and the little wax candles that melt in about 5 minutes dripping down his hand, but you can't do anything about the molten wax because you're in church and you're singing on Easter. So that was kind of, you know, that was how life went in the early 50s in Detroit if you were a Greek. Until one day, you know, age six, he's feeling a little run down before school. Mom, I don't feel so well. So they go to the doctor and he's diagnosed with leukemia and given 2 weeks to live. So obviously that's not what you want to hear as a parent. So my grandma goes to the church, as you do when it's the 50s, and being a Greek American puts you in a very specific tribe, and you can't really expect to get aid or help from outside that tribe. And she talks to the Orthodox priest, you know, father, it's been a bad week. You know, my son is going to die in 8 days. And, you know, it was a different time and a different place than the one we live in now. But these guys basically looked at her and said, well, that's God's will, and we'll see you on Sunday morning. So, you know, and my grandmother was not a stereotypically tough woman. She was in some ways, you know, rather timid, but she was also an intellectual, and she was also quite sure of her instincts about what had integrity to it and what did not. So she looked at this guy, you know, the priest in her church, and she said, "You don't believe what we teach the little boys and girls in Sunday school." And she walked out. And that was the end of the Orthodox Church in the Greek side of my family line.
Wow.
So not, you know, not until a couple of years ago, talking to my dad about this, actually while I was first beginning to write the book, Did he say, you know, one of my earliest memories is sitting in the living room with my mom, and she's watching TV, and you know, it's this black and white monstrosity from the early 50s, and she's watching with rapt attention this very peculiar looking woman in some kind of interview. And this woman's got, you know, this strange hat and seems vaguely European and is smoking a cigarette through a cigarette holder, and she was watching one of Rand's first televised interviews. So here's, you know, here's my Greek grandma, who will not appear in any history books, having this moment of realization in a theological way, but also as an individual,
right,
called to choose in a fundamental way how her life and her child's life, and you know, God willing, his progeny, would go on, and she put the individual conscience first. So long story short, too late. My father and my mom as well were then raised as 1960s Protestants.
Wow.
They met at a youth group. You know, they were, Ted Nugent played my dad's high school, you know, it's that kind of situation. And that seemed to be a stable way for them to practice their Christianity. Mm-hmm. But in a couple of years, their church, you know, went full hippie. And it took them a couple months to realize that that the writing was on the wall. And unless they wanted to sort of sit around and play acoustic guitars in a patchouli fart cloud, they'd better leave that church too. So I was raised thoroughly unchurched, but nonetheless quite seriously Christian as a sort of intellectual and theological proposition. And although that was, you know, had brought its own awkwardness along with it, you know, it's a weird place to be as a kid growing up, as a teenager, when you've got your sort of like born again Foursquare church friends on one side, and then sort of like your, you know, your art class friends with their own shirts on the other side. Mm-hmm. And you're like, where do I belong? And the answer is, you know, nowhere. And that's fine.
Right.
You know, that's not the end of the world. In fact, in some ways, it might be the beginning of the world.
So, and that also is a world, you know, and obviously we can say politics infuses everything, or, you know, it, I mean, just as religion or faith or lack of faith infuses everything. But it's something that's distinct from politics, and it doesn't have the, you know, it's just working in a different register of meaning and significance and action. And part of what the book is about is how to escape politics. But you also, in the chapter about money, which I thought was really sharp too, and particularly for a kind of libertarian audience, you know, talk a little bit about both your sense of things, but also Tocqueville's anxieties or fear that money or materialism gets in the way of having a satisfied life. And that is not, you know, I know that you are not anti-free market or anything like that, but that we have, you know, there is a sense that if everything is about status and status is expressed through money, we can never be happy, basically. And so What is the function of money, or how do we change our relationship in your book with money in order to get a little bit more free?
Yeah, you know, I mean, money is the great equalizer in a way, because money is the closest we can get to the fantasy of making everything commensurate or interchangeable. You know, if I have a big pile of something I don't want, and you have a big pile of something you don't want, money is the magic that makes us switch places in that respect and both be better off.
If I can say, you know, for anybody mm-hmm. listening, when you have gifts to give, cash is the greatest gift because the receiver can turn it into whatever they want, which is better than, you know, giving them a crock pot or a set of knives that they already have.
Or would never buy.
That's yes, and, true. Don't even get me started on the awesome. Yeah, on the gift economy. The gift economy is the great enslaver of humankind. But in any case. But yeah, but talk about money, because this is not you're not counseling that we become like Buddhist monks or something and give away all our possessions and live in a hut somewhere. It's more that we need to have if we want to be free from a kind of persistent anxiety and loneliness, despair, we need a different relationship to money, or what you talk about being against monetariness of life. So explain that.
Right. So, the problem with the magic of money is that it can incline us, especially under stress, to think that we can't be happy unless we have it all. There's this sort of totalizing thing about money where it's like, well, shit, if the value of everything can sort of be cashed out, if it's ultimately all just cash value, then I should be able to sort of, if the only thing standing between me and all of what I want is just more money, that's going to be very aggravating and frustrating position to be in, regardless of how much money you have. You know, there are many great sages of the modern age have cautioned that the more money you have, the more problems you'll have. This is not like some controversial claim, but it is harder maybe to put into practice than it is to talk about. And that's because we are afraid that if we lessen up on competition, then we're going to be boxed out or we're going to be frozen out. I always go back to Hunter Thompson's report from Palm Beach during the Roxanne Pulitzer trial. And, there's this whole long riff in there about a guy ranting to him that he feels like a dog took his place. And the first couple times I read that, I thought, what are you talking about, Hunter? This makes no sense. But in fact, it is, it is that feeling where just because of how the economy is working, or just because, some people are willing to be more ambitious or more amoral or happen to be luckier, whatever, there are endless variables at work that could put someone in a more advantageous economic position than you. And that grinding sort of bitterness that, the only thing between me and my happiness is more money, regardless of how much money I have. That is always going to make it harder for us to choose freedom and to experience freedom. And I know that, for my socialist bros out there who think that justice involves handing people without money, they're going to be resistant to what it is that I'm trying to say. And I certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't want to pretend that on balance, having less money is going to make you more happy. But again, this book is called The Art of Being Free. It's not the art of being happy. It's not the art of being prosperous. It's not even the art of feeling good. It's about how to access freedom in your life, regardless of your position or your fortunes in life. And if you want to do that, don't pursue the art of the deal. Bargaining, great deals, those are awesome. They're part of American life, but they're not the door that we want to walk through. And if we expect freedom to be on the other side, we're going to be disappointed.
So in this book, this is not a kind of, it doesn't end in a place of, say Candide, Voltaire's novella, where the counseling is not simply to go home and tend your own gardens and, kind of just stay within your little limited world where you can kind of control things or anything. It isn't that at all. But talk a bit about, so what does freedom consist of? Because you're not saying freedom doesn't consist of having fewer commitments or having fewer connections or having fewer expectations or ambitions. But what does it consists of that for you? Or is it a state mindset? It's being free is something different than freedom. Clarify that a bit.
Right. So there is an important way in which it is a practice. It is an experience. It's sort of something that you would need an adverb to describe rather than a noun or an adjective. One great way to dig into this is to look at Tocqueville's remarks on the Puritans. For Tocqueville, if you want to understand the American character, you have to go back to its point of origin. And as Nietzsche once said, we Democrats, small d Democrats, have this persistent bias against all questions of origin. We don't like the idea that the way that we are has sort of been determined for us by where we came from. But sure enough, if you go back with Tocqueville and you look at the Puritans.
Oh, and I'm sorry to interrupt if I can say, you know, that is enshrined in the national anthem of talking about how Americans don't know much about history, right? We abjure really understanding where we come from in many ways because it raises a lot of uncomfortable questions. All, you know, either you were once great and now you're reduced, or you were once poor and now you're up on the hill. Nobody wants to, you know, that it's an ongoing complaint that actually goes back to the Puritans, that we're not taking our own origin stories very seriously.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's this fear that if you go back to the origin, you're going to wind up with sort of less freedom. You're going to have less room to choose, you know, who you are or how to sort of what your options are going forward. But Tocqueville suggests that it is because the Puritans had anchored their hearts in something that's fixed and stable theologically, that they were free to roam so widely and broadly across the entire rest of human endeavor. You know, science, commerce, technology, history, politics. You know, the politics in America could be so crazy because Americans could, you know, swing their pendulum back to a fixed point where all was not in turmoil. And so the great insight of Tocqueville's is that, you know, if you do anchor your heart, if you do make it a stable site for practices that have integrity and that you can rely on and that you can importantly share with others, you know, freedom is very hard to envision absent friendship. If you do that, then you will find that you have, you know, yes, a tether of sorts to that fixed point, but it's a very long tether, and it gives you a lot of room to range very freely. You know, this is a controversial point, but Tocqueville suggested that Islam, for instance, does not provide people with that same sort of dynamic, and that if you have a religion that imposes clear demands on the range of human endeavor, it is going to be at odds with the age in which we live, and that it is going to maybe push people into a degree of craziness that is very hard to bear psychologically. So I wanted to take that sort of basket of insights from Tocqueville and suggest that, you know, regardless of where you wind up doctrinally on sort of the ultimate questions of human life, if they do put you in a position where you can anchor your heart, especially through friendship, and especially with an eye toward the durable things in human life, including human life itself, you know, going on to future generations, then that will be a great aid to you in having the presence of mind and also sort of the grace under pressure that is really indispensable to flourishing amid what is going to be indefinitely a very crazy daily life.
Yeah, and you at one point you equate the art of being free with the art of dealing with it. That it's you know, that it isn't a you know, we don't break through the final, you know, piece of rock in the in the wall and land in Eden, where then we don't have to do anything anymore. This is, I mean, it's your book seems to be indebted both explicitly and implicitly to a kind of existentialist Christianity of, you know, it's kind of Camus' Sisyphus, you know, with a lot more interesting allusions to it, particularly the ones that talk about Seinfeld and whatnot. As far as I'm concerned, but talk as a kind of closing discussion. You were born in 1979, and you talk about in the book that you had started writing a novel in 1999, and then the kind of enterprise of that was, apart from anything else, was just kind of made you know, it seemed irrelevant after 9/11. What is a, you know, what is a lesson for somebody who's your age, who remembers this period where you were coming of age and into adulthood before 9/11? What was lost by the rupture of 9/11 that is worth kind of recovering and using as a basis for reimagining a different way forward that is not simply more of what we've seen in the 21st century, which I think many of us, certainly in America, would say is kind of disappointing. You know, the future is here. We dreamed about it for a long time, and it's not exactly what we were expecting. We were thinking we would be in a world that had more optimism and more enthusiasm. And instead, you know, we just came out of a presidential race where neither awful candidate could get 50%. One could win the popular vote. One could win the electoral vote. We, class consciousness, racial enmity seems to be edging up. Crime might be coming back. What is there from your early youth or early adulthood that you think is worth recapturing?
Man, I mean, one place I always go back to is that sort of as the mid-90s turned into the late-90s and all of your favorite grunge and post-grunge bands that were actually truly great musicians were suddenly handed vast sums of money and allowed to make these incredibly well-produced music videos and became sort of rock superstars on a level that, you know, even 5 years ago seemed insanely impossible, right? You went from like Flannel and you went from like that first Hole record and you went from Gish and you went from Portrait of an American Family. You know, you went from that to like... to Melancholy and to Mechanical Animals and Celebrity Skin. And it was this dramatic transformation, but it was also quite organic, which was remarkable for me to experience as like a 16 and 17 year old who had certain pretensions as you do at that age.
Sure.
But it was also sort of like there was a way in which even though the boom time suggested creatively that this vast new reservoir of energy and dynamism and possibility was being tapped, it was also laced with this kind of weirdly dark warning about where things were going. And so, you know, things moved very quickly. 97, 98, very upbeat. But also increasingly aggressive, and the dark edge of glamour was coming into view, as you know, fans of Virginia Pastrell listening to this podcast might recall. And then 1999, we had Columbine. 1999, we had the battle in Seattle. 1999, we had, you know, Y2K apocalypticism. And 1999 we had Slobodan Milosevic, and we had bombing Christians on Easter, and we had, you know, I was in London in spring of 99 doing the obligatory study abroad thing, and Balkan gentlemen missing limbs were hobbling up and down the tube, and old ladies in pillbox hats were refusing to give them money. And working class British people were saying unflattering things about said old ladies in pillbox hats. And it was, you know, there was a change that was underway. 1999 was when Bret Easton Ellis's masterpiece Glamorama came out. And if you want to understand what was going on in 1999, you've got to go read that book. Whether or not you thought American Psycho was good. Not enough people have read that book, and they should. But to sort of, you know, to actually answer your question here, one of the other sort of great touchstones for my book and for my interpretation of Tocqueville was in American Psycho, where Patrick Bateman, who worships Donald Trump, repeatedly throughout American Psycho, has this kind of annoyingly younger brother, Sean Bateman, who is clearly from a different generation and represents a kind of a final end to the 80s and the birth of something else. And Sean is the main character of the other book, Rules of Attraction, which was made into a film with some truly frightening James Van Der Beek face in it, if that sort of thing is appealing to you.
Oh, I think it's underappreciated.
And Sean's catchphrase was "deal with it."
Yeah.
Not in the way of bargaining. You know, for Sean Bateman, "deal with it" means bargaining time is over, man. And for the Donald Trump of American Psycho, you know, the art of the deal is it's always bargaining time. That you can always, you know, you can always try to bargain your way out of a situation or into greater advantage. And here comes, you know, the late 90s saying, you know, in spite of how awesomely everything around us is glittering, we're about to hit some kind of wall and we're about to hit this reckoning where you have to deal with it, not in the art of the deal sense, but in the sense of like, these are the conditions that you are stuck with and what are you going to choose now? And so the going through that experience and going through it between the ages of 15 and 18, I feel like it prepared me and people in that kind of generational cohort for the post 9/11, post 2008 experience in a way that the younger generations, did not get, you know, they didn't get the tutorial, you know, and I can't help but look on many of the millennials, not as, you know, as sort of powerless fools who need to grow up, you know, but people who just like they did not get the experience that would prepare them for the world into which they were thrust. And I think, you know, the ongoing sort of pathos of Trump trauma is a testament to how urgent of a necessity it is for people, regardless of how old they are, to kind of be able to like log off of twitter.com or like put the phone down or, you know, go on the ayahuasca retreat or whatever, just like take a pause and clear a space where you can anchor yourself and get up to speed on reality. And when you do, I think possibilities for freedom that are empowering, regardless of who you are, regardless of what your fortunes are, will open up to you. And when they do, and when that happens in concert with those who are close to you, not your BFFs and not just your fake Facebook friends, but people in that kind of middle space who are similar to you in some ways, but not in others, people you can build trust with without it being sort of like a boring or masturbatory exercise. If you take that journey with people like that in your life, I think it will hearten you for what is to come, which may be terrible. It always might be terrible. And there's always a choice waiting for you about how you will live, regardless of what happens.
Oh, thank you so much. We're gonna leave it there because that's a wonderful way to, you know, it's a wonderful vision of a different path forward. And I was going to ask you, you know, how do you take this from the personal into the social? And I think that you've laid out a basic way of doing that. So I want to thank you. James, we have been talking with James Polis. He is the author of the brilliant new book, The Art of Being Free, which tells us about what Tocqueville can teach us in contemporary America. James, thanks so much for talking with Reason.
It's such a pleasure, Nick. Very grateful.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.